to welcome back Dan Spencer, Professor of Environmental Studies at University of Montana. And this is Journey of the Universe, Part 2. Thank you, Dan.
Thank you, Sam. Yeah, thank you so much for coming back, and especially, it's such a beautiful day. I always feel, you know, a little guilty competing against the grandeur out there, but we're going to tell you, this is a, one of the things I forgot to mention last time is the authors of this movie, and they have a little book by the same name, which is just a wonderful, very readable book if you're just in, be more called again, Journey of the Universe. But I love their phrase that they talk about why they're doing this, and I'll just read this opening line here, because I think for the setting at Holden, this is so appropriate. They say about this project that this is an invitation to a journey into grandeur. An invitation to a journey into grandeur. And that's why we started to look at the big picture of it last time. We're going to be focusing much more now about the emergence of complex life, particularly mammals, and then human beings within that. So just a review of a few key things we talked about last time, we'll pick up again here. Part of what they're trying to do in this story that they're telling is to show how human beings, how we are a combination of deep continuity with the patterns of the universe, but we're also the emergence of something new in the universe. And so we have both deep continuity, and they talk about two key patterns or forces in the universe, this interaction between the forces of attraction, gravity being part of that, and the force of expansion, the universe being driven out. And this tug back and forth on that creates stars, creates all these different dynamics, and we're part of that as well. This emergence of novelty, that at several key points along the story of the universe, something new emerges from a new arrangement of parts and things that couldn't have been predicted before. So complex molecular structures, for example, emerge from the basic particles. That leads to the possibility of stars emerging as self-organizing energy centers. Stars emerge, and that creates the possibility of combining them in structures we know as galaxies. All these different things. And then life itself is the emergence of a whole new way of self-organizing in the universe here. And human beings become the latest part of that emergence of novelty, of newness in the universe that can't really be predicted by what's come before. Talk a little bit about that amazing thing that the physicists, and by the way, I should report to you, I am not a physicist. So what I'm reporting to you is what I've learned from them, but I have to pretty much take their word for it because I do not have the mathematical abilities to examine and test what they're talking about. But one of the really interesting things is what some people have called the anthropic principle, this notion that the universe expanded at just the right rate to make all this, these structures and novelty possible. If it had expanded just a little bit more slowly, it would have forces of gravity would have collapsed it back in on itself. If it expanded just a little bit more quickly, it would have just expanded indefinitely into diffuse kind of matter out there. So we live in this elegantly designed or structured universe on that. And it's made up, what do we call it, nested self-organizing processes. Now, nested processes, any of you remember the Russian dolls where you have one big doll and you pull it out, and those are called nested. So when something exists within something else, we call them nested processes. And what we see in the universe over and over again is these series of nested self-organizing processes. Everything from the level of a star or a galaxy, just enormous thing that are self-organizing within themselves, all the way down to individual cells. When they started looking at the individual cell with its membrane and its nucleus, and it's a self-organizing entity within its own entity there. And then we're somewhere in between as complex organisms, largely self-organizing within ourselves. So the universe, so we're a reflection of that general pattern of the universe, but we have some really distinctive qualities for us as well. A couple other things here. One of the things that my field of geology, and it was really fun, I started studying geology in the late 60s and the early 70s, having no idea that I was on the very cutting edge of a revolution in geology, which is the emergence of what's known as plate tectonics. This notion that the surface of our Earth is moving with respect to each other. I'm going to talk more about that tomorrow when I talk about the geological history of this area here. But what that means is that the Earth's surface is constantly renewing itself. And so we can look at the surface of the moon and date those rocks there, and they're over 3 billion years old. You can find almost nothing on the surface of our Earth today that old. There are a few scattered rocks there because the Earth is constantly renewing itself, and that means it's renewing the conditions for life constantly. So we live on this living planet. We're going to talk a little more about Gaia theory, this theory that the Earth itself is kind of self-regulating itself to make the conditions for life possible and to sustain those. So we're going to move into the second part today, and I put up a few different things we'll come back and talk about here. This first little section talks about the energy at the center of life itself, which we're going to talk about is passion and desire, which makes life possible to continue there. We looked a little bit last time about the mystery that life depends on predation, depends on the death of other forms of life to keep life going, and that raises real profound questions, mystery around that. But we're going to focus particularly around the emergence of human beings and what makes us both in continuity with other forms of life, but also distinctive in some important ways. So I'm going to start the movie. We'll go for about 25 minutes, and I'll break you up for about 5 minutes in small groups again to just to talk about it, and then we'll just raise general questions on that. This will be a little bit of repeat from where we were, but we'll pick up.
And this capacity to see into the depths of time gives new meaning to death. The universe throughout space and time is filled with violence and chaos. Millions of galaxies have been destroyed. Trillions of animals have been killed. Death and suffering are woven into the very heart of the universe. Usually such destruction is massive and senseless. A volcano erupts and kills every living being in its vicinity. Dealing with death leads to more complex co-evolutionary relationships. For a rabbit, an eagle wears the face of destruction. But in this relationship, the eagle develops more acute eyesight, and the rabbit develops greater speed for escape. Interdependent communities arise out of suffering and death. The ultimate meaning of this escapes easy explanation. We are confronted with a fundamental mystery in which the small self of the individual dives into and nourishes the whole community. But living beings are not just linked together by food. Passion, our urge to merge. What could be more intimate to our souls? Our passions determine so much of our lives. They are the wild, explosive energies of all of love and creativity. And such desire resides at the very center of life. With fish, the female deposits her eggs, and the male later fertilizes them. There's no contact. A 100 million years later, when the lizards have evolved out of their fish and amphibian ancestors, the passion to merge has deepened considerably. With mammals and birds, passions reach yet a new crescendo. Not only are they able to commingle as one body, they can become so profoundly bonded they remain in relationship their entire lives. We are not just similar to animals, we have been shaped by them. Our passions come from vertebrate evolution. Even our compassion can be understood as an expansion of what took place hundreds of millions of years ago in the ocean with the early fish. Biologists speculate that mutations led to a mother fish who scared away predators from her babies. This behavior was new at that time. What was more common among fish back then was a mother who ate her young. With the emergence of the fish's descendants, mammals and birds, maternal care broadened. Now the offspring are not just protected from predators, but were nourished directly by their mother. This care even included transmission of survival information of their group. And in some cases, this required years of training. We see there that caring behavior among vertebrates expanded to 500 million years before the emergence of Homo sapiens. Earlier humans intuited this deepening compassion and celebrated it with images of the divine feminine. As we enter into evening here on Samos, we approach one of the deep mysteries at the center of every traditional cosmic story, the nature and ultimate meaning of the human. We humans have our origin in the birth of the universe 14 billion years ago, and thus we are composed of the same energy and quanta as that which composes everything in the universe. And we fall from the first self, emerging 4 billion years ago. So we're genetic cousins to every living being. So what is distinct about us? What is unique human? Our current best evidence suggests that something took place between 6 and 7 million years ago in Africa. Something happened to ignite the human lineage in the primate world. A new line of energetic apes emerged that would, over several million years, bring forth massive brains and learn to dwell in a world saturated with dreams. Nothing like them had ever existed before. So, what gave rise to us? We don't really know. We don't have the detailed knowledge of that transformation yet. We're forced to speculate on the data. And perhaps that's entirely appropriate here in the night, to be forced to dream about the origins of this dream-making animal. One theory offered by the scientists is particularly fascinating. It suggests that humanity had its origin in the prolongation of childhood. The idea is that mutations took place, which slowed down our development. Humans went through the same phases as, say, the chimpanzees, but they remained at each stage for a longer period of time. In particular, this meant that the humans were childlike for more of their lives than other mammals. So, to understand what makes a human human, we can study the children of any mammalian species. They jump to play. They explore the world with their eyes, and they taste the world with their mouths. Simple existence thrills them. Their actions are, in some sense, free. So, after nearly 4 billion years, an animal emerged that could remain free, spontaneous, curious, flexible, open, impelled to try everything. So what was going to happen now? Early humans awoke to an incandescent consciousness. But where other animals were controlled by instincts, humans were liberated from such set reactions. Captivated by the thrill of movement, we could make dance or sports central to our lives. Astonished by the sounds of Earth, we could dedicate ourselves to the joy of making music. Or making love. The greatest creation in human history was what enabled humans to plunge into and to share their superabundant consciousness. This new invention was language. More simply, the symbol. The symbols of language and art and mathematics opened up new depths of consciousness.
each human began to carry an entire universe within. This new form of consciousness, called symbolic consciousness, would soon change everything.
A crucial step in the process of becoming human was learning to externalize consciousness, to represent in the physical world what we had experienced within. This is the archaeological museum on the island of Samos. Come and have a look. By creating marks on bone or in wet clay, humans invented a way to fix their knowledge into an enduring form outside of themselves. The coding processes of life were bursting beyond the DNA molecule. So with human culture, experience itself can be remembered and passed down for thousands of years. Not just successful mutations, any valuable understanding, even if experienced by a single human being, can become part of the enduring legacy. Works of the mind and spirit flowed into Samos from every direction of the ancient world, from Athens and Mesopotamia, as well as Spain, Egypt, Persia. You know, in the early universe, concentrations of matter led to the emergence of galaxies, and something similar was going on here. In Samos and in other cities, we find a concentration of symbolic constructions. What does this mean, really? It means that rare insights and deep feelings from around the planet and from different eras of time are all folded together here. Out of this powerful alchemical mixing, human consciousness complexified into new forms.
By the science of genetics. What is it
even the seeds begin to live not just in the earth, but in an earth shaped by human consciousness. With their equations and their measurements, the early scientists discovered truths none of the classical scholars had known. In astronomy, chemistry, physiology, humans began to understand the world with their numbers and patterns. The defining characteristic of this new modern form of consciousness was the decision to employ our science and technology to control nature for our own use. Widespread conviction of the industrial world was that nature was inferior to us. Such a worldview in which only humans have sentient feelings allowed all of nature to become nothing more than a resource we could exploit in any way we wished. Even René Descartes, the most significant philosopher of the modern age, believed that when animals made crying sounds, they were not suffering. They were simply malfunctioning machines. Humans were gaining control of Earth's processes. And to what purpose? To create a better world, to eliminate hunger, to provide for our children, to have fun. And to fulfill this dream, we poured forth all of our energies, all of our technologies, and with stupendous results. In the blink of an eye, we exploded to 7 billion humans. Iron Daniel, housing and feeding this many humans has already gutted our oceans and forests. We've ended up achieving something like the opposite of what we dreamt of. It's not just a reusing of all the energies of Earth. It's much deeper than that. We're changing life's dynamics, and in an irreversible way. Just beginning to realize that over the last few decades, we have profoundly altered the evolutionary dynamics of Earth, the air, the climate, the rivers, the oceans, even the DNA. We live on a different planet now, a planet where not biology, symbolic consciousness is the determining factor for evolution. This great reversal has taken place. In the far distant past, life drew forth symbolic consciousness. But now symbolic consciousness has seized control of life. With our languages and our machines, we have become as powerful as the planet itself. Because of us, us capture nothing. Because of us, coral reefs the size of mountains are bleaching white. But nothing shows this disaster more clearly than life itself. Because of us, thousands of species are going extinct each year. Nothing this devastating has taken place on Earth since the extinction of the dinosaurs 65 million years ago. We are faced with a collective challenge no previous generation even contemplated. How are we to use this symbolic consciousness to create a human presence that will enhance the well-being of the Earth community? We are beginning to understand the profound powers of the universe. And just as these powers have brought forth galaxies, stars, and life itself, Perhaps the universe is now unfolding towards some new destiny. What if our ultimate destiny is to experience the universe so deeply we come to realize that we are, in some sense, the mind and heart of the universe? Our deepest yearning is for a wholehearted participation in this flourishing. As we float in the midst of such mysterious immensities, is there any deep wisdom that might help us align our consciousness with the grain of cosmic evolution?
Wonder will guide us. The human species has a genius for becoming astounded by almost anything in the universe. What can this mean?
The body of the universe gave birth to our bodies. The self-organizing dynamics of the universe gave birth to our minds. We belong here. We've always belonged here. These deep discoveries of science are leading to a new story of the universe. It's a story that can be summarized in a single sentence. Over the course of 14 billion years, hydrogen gas transformed itself into mountains, butterflies, the music of Bach, and you and me. And these energies coursing through us may indeed renew the face of the earth.
Before we start our big conversation, I just want to invite you again to turn to a few people around you and just talk a little bit about anything that was particularly interesting, puzzling, exciting, aggravating, whatever, that turns it around there, and one or two insights that you picked up that you think were important from this part of the documentary, and then I'll get the board up here and we'll use that to start building our conversation together about some of the implications of this new story. Let's just see if we got somebody who's willing to get us our conversation started with something that came up in your small group conversation you found interesting, would like to discuss further, or a question, something, and we'll see if we can weave this all together. A lot of material in this last section here. Yes, here.
Well, we were just talking about how this conversation connects with the one that we heard this morning with Bart Russing, and I mean, this can be really depressing, what we've just watched, but is it maybe that sort of a wake-up call that came up? Is this? Do we have the opportunity to make different choices? And is this maybe a message more of hope than of despair?
Yeah. Let me take a listen. Did everybody hear the comment on that? The connections with what Barbara Rossing was talking about this morning, and that kind of the pregnancy of the time, that we can read it either as a kind of a movement into despair, but also as a wake-up call about what we can be doing here. And one of the things I want to pick up on, when I work with my students on this in our classes here, this notion that with human beings, we talked about this emergence of novelty, but with human beings, the capacity for symbolic consciousness has entered into the universe story. And why don't I just pause here for a moment and see what this might mean and the implications of this. As far as we know, this is quite possible that other parts of the universe, we don't have access to huge, huge, huge parts of the universe, so we don't know what's going on there. But on our own corner, it took about 13.5 billion years for the capacity for symbolic consciousness to emerge. That is, the capacity for an organism that could be freed up enough from just instinct dictated by DNA to start thinking creatively, or, as they talk about, for the universe to begin to reflect on itself. So in that sense, the universe has become self-reflective through us. And it's kind of an amazing kind of thing about this here. But the mystery or the challenge with this is this rise of symbolic consciousness brings tremendous power and tremendous potentiality with it here. We've seen this particularly in the last 200 years with the rise, particularly in the West initially, with the Renaissance, the Enlightenment, the scientific revolution that's led to the Industrial Revolution, where this power to be able to think in symbolic terms or abstract concepts of the world has really led to a transformation of the world. And we are now in the midst of, I'll back up one thing here. Geologists are actually debating right now whether we've come to the end of a geological era. The last 65 million years is an era that the geologists call the Cenozoic. And the Cenozoic began about 65 million years ago, we think, with the strike of a large meteor or comet that hit the Earth and caused the extinction of well over half of all life species on the planet, including dinosaurs. Tragedy for those life species, a real blessing for us, because without that, it's quite likely dinosaurs would still be the dominant life form on the planet. Instead, these little furry creatures that lived at that time survived that. They're called mammals. And then out of mammals began to complexify the incredible biodiversity of life that we experience in our world today. You saw some beautiful images of that, including us. But we are this current situation we're in right now, the animal and plant world is going extinct at such a fast rate now that it's mirroring what happened 65 million years ago. And so with this rise of symbolic consciousness, this one species that can think in abstract or symbolic terms has come this tremendous power, and it's power for good, but also real destructive power. And it raises an open question. Can the planet actually live with this kind of power on it? Can it survive this incredible increase in power here? And another way it really connects nicely with both what Hal Taussig was talking about this morning with the thunder being notion. I didn't get the name right. What's the?
Thunder, perfect mind.
Thunder, yes, great thunder, perfect mind. The one of these early Christian community writings there. And then also what Barb was talking about with the book of Revelation. One of the most incredible things that has allowed human beings, as Homo sapiens, to get this incredible power is our ability to tell stories. And it's something it sometimes feels so trivial in some way, because we equate, you tell stories to children, you tell stories there. But with storytelling comes the capacity to organize enormous numbers of people and to get them to cooperate. I brought this book with me here, so I want to mention it. Anybody familiar with the book Sapiens by Yuval Harari? It's one of the most interesting books I've read in the last few years. It just came out a couple years ago. It tells the story of our emergence of our species. One thing that, I mean, maybe other people are aware of this, but I was not aware that when Homo sapiens emerged, there were several other species of humans on the planet at the same time. Many of us are familiar, for example, the Neanderthals lived there, but there were at least 10 or 11 other Homo species there. And Homo sapiens, it's been a relatively rapid period. Once that species moved out of Africa, encountered all these other species and eliminated them. And we think it's probably because of this incredible power of symbolic consciousness. One of the things that happens with that, if you can tell a unifying story, right? you can get people to do all sorts of things together that you can't in the absence of that. And so if we say we're all Americans, right? We all have that common story together, you can get 300 million people to essentially act together. Or we're all Christians. We all follow the biblical story. You can get a large number of people to that. We all belong to Holden Village. Right? This ability to tell stories that embed our deepest values and things in them allow us to do incredible feats of cooperation that simply are not found in other species that are tied primarily by DNA. But with that, you can also be a Nazi Germany. You can unify people under a common story that can do incredibly destructive things as well. So it raises this open question. You know, this is an incredible new leap into a power that simply is unknown of before in the universe. And can we learn to live with it in a constructive way? That's, I think, the challenge of our age. Yeah.
I think another question that's occurred to me before is, what sort of time scale are we willing to work at? Because as we, you know, as we saw, the forces that brought us to where we are now took billions, millions, you know, hundreds of thousands, tens of thousands of years. Very few of them took days, weeks, months, and yet that's kind of the time scale we like to operate in. That's where we feel comfortable, where I can see the change.
You know, it's fascinating, you know, and change is happening so incredibly rapidly. I suspect virtually everybody in the room here can already start thinking about it. I mean, I tell my students, for example, that I learned my mathematics in college with a slide rule, because we didn't have even little hand calculators yet at that point. I started teaching in that college before the web was around. We had no internet, no web, and my students, and let alone smartphones. Things like this. I mean, the amount of change is happening so rapidly. You know, my grandparents remember the very first automobiles, and they lived easily long enough to see the first human beings on the moon. And you know, this kind of change is happening so incredibly rapidly, coming from this incredible capacity. But what does it mean for us? And this is part of, I think, one of the real challenges we have. This story of the emergence of the human here, and when we talk about symbolic consciousness, what we're talking about is the emergence of culture. And human beings are guided by two intersecting behavioral constraints. One is our DNA. We have that in continuity with every other life form here. And so a lot of who we are and how we act is non-conscious. It's controlled by our DNA in ways that we're finding more and more have real constraints on that here. But we also have culture. And culture is, in some ways, this externalized consciousness. We take the consciousness we experience internally there, we put in a group there, and it becomes externalized into culture here. And culture can lead to incredible achievements, but also real challenges. And so what we oftentimes see now is that we've got real conflicts between what our DNA is telling us and what our culture is making available to us. So one example here is diet. Okay, we have tens of thousands of years of genetic training in our DNA that says if you come across something really sweet, you may not see it again. So eat as much of it as you can. Right. So because of our ancestors, they came across some honey or a fruit tree or something like that. This was a real opportunity to stack up on that. They weren't anticipating the Holden snack bar, right? They weren't anticipating the fact that our diet today makes us prone to now, who would imagine that obesity would emerge as the number one issue related to food in our world? But we now have far more people in the world who are obese than we do who are hungry. You know, and that's a situation where our DNA and our culture are not in sync with each other. And the more rapidly our culture expands, the more we keep having these challenges. So it's an open question again about how well we'll be successfully able to encounter this. Other thoughts or insights that came up for folks? Yes?
How does God and our faith fit into the point in time where Homo sapiens became us?
Yeah.
You know, I mean, God made in the image of God. We're different than the animals. So how does that all fit into all this scientific thing?
Yeah. Anybody want to venture some thoughts? I mean, that's one of the key questions here.
No, really, because I was thinking, you know, I mean, I've never had a problem with evolution before, but I thought that God can work, you know, through all that. But there has to be some kind of point in time.
Yeah. go back here.
If you're asking that question, there's a series of Gifford lectures from a number of years ago and published in a book called Alone in the Universe, and it discusses at great length the place of the image of God ideas and the human evolution. So it's called Alone in the Universe.
Alone in the Universe, which is a really interesting title, because so much of what this whole story is talking about is the fact that we're not alone in the universe, that actually we're part of this incredible community, but we have some really distinctive qualities. I did bring one book with me because I was part of a conference. A lot of this story, the universe story, came originally from a thinker named Thomas Berry. And he was actually quoted in the Holden Orientation as kind of an eco-theologian. And he was a Roman Catholic priest and theologian, but he was also trained in history. And he was really fascinated by how every world religion tells these orienting stories that make the difference for how that community lives. If you remember what Hal Tausig, if you've been at Hal's talks here in the morning, what he's been talking to us about is how things like the Gospel of Mark or these other stories there were written in such a way to help those communities make sense of and live through their times. And so when we look at, for example, the four Gospels we have in our New Testament of Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, each of them seems to have been written in a particular time, a particular place to help that community. They all draw from the same material, the teachings of Jesus, the life story of Jesus, the biblical tradition, but they shape the way they tell the story to help address those questions. And that's what we were sort of looking at this morning. Barbara talked about that with the book of Revelation as well. What would it be like, for example, to be a Jewish refugee from this incredible war where Rome had come in and destroyed the Holy Land, and now you find yourself as a refugee elsewhere, and you're trying to make sense of your situation. You're trying to take these stories of the people come before and combine them with the Jesus traditions and tell them in such a way that makes sense. That's sort of what this story is trying to challenge today. We say now, what does it mean to take all these things that we've been thinking about, that we've been talking about here, but now we have a much, much larger context than our ancestors could ever have even imagined there. And I brought up Thomas Berry because he was born in 1914, and so on the 100th anniversary of his birth, there was a conference on the Forum on Religion and Ecology back at Yale to celebrate that. And it brought together about 150 different Christian theologians and thinkers to reflect on what does this story mean now for the way we think of the Christian story, these great themes in there. A lot of those papers are published in this book called Living Cosmology. All I can do is really think out loud, okay? One of the things that I've tried to talk about here is that if you think about the Genesis story, and then when I work with talking to my students about this, the Genesis story, I think, emphasizes some very similar themes here in terms of who human beings are. It says, first of all, that we're in great continuity with the rest of God's creation. So, for example, human beings, we don't get our own day. Right? We're created on the sixth day, but we share that day with all the other earth creatures, the land animals, things like that. So, at some level, we're deeply connected to all the other land mammals and creatures like that. However, we're set aside as being created in the image of God. So there's this awareness of something distinctive about us that differentiates us from all the other members there. I think there's a lot of that similar kind of thing going on in this story here. When you're talking about human beings, we're definitely children of the universe. We share all those qualities. But with human beings, this emergence of symbolic consciousness comes a whole new capacity that distinguishes us from our other members there. So I can make sense of the Genesis teachings in that, to have to bring that in here. But I also think, and this is where it sometimes gets controversial, I also think that this story in some ways radically de-centers us from the story. We don't lose our distinctiveness. But if you start thinking about a universe that has at a minimum 200 billion galaxies, and you start thinking about each of those galaxies having 100 billion or 200 billion stars, and what we're increasingly finding just in the last few years is almost all of these stars seem to have planets around them. So they probably have solar systems. Now take that with the great Christian theme or the biblical theme of God is the God of all. It doesn't lessen God's concern for us in some sense, but it certainly seems to expand it. That's a much, much bigger universe for God to be involved in. And I can only guess, and you think about God creating all of creation as good, loving all of creation. Well, that's a really, really big creation. And so it's, I don't want to minimize God's concern for us, but I also want to say it's probably really big. There's a heck of a lot more out there that concerns that. And so I think that some, one of the effects of the story for me is I think it can bring in a healthy sense of humility, a kind of decentering ourselves as the only thing that matters at the same time, which I think is a good corrective because we have this incredible power to do not only good, but to do harm on that. So if we can, you know, and I think there's other parts of the biblical story that would emphasize that, but it does call for not just Christianity, every religious tradition, every set of stories is having to rethink what their claims make in terms of how we think about fitting into this much, much bigger story on that. Yeah.
So is there something that will come after symbolic consciousness that's called humility consciousness or something, some next phase of human depth?
You know, it's really, that's a wonderful question. This question is there something that will come after symbolic consciousness that the next stage that may be humility consciousness here? Let me give you two different possibilities that are reflected in the wording people are choosing to talk about this new era. One of the really common, so I mentioned we've gone from the Cenozoic as a geological era of the last 65 million years. It seems to have come to an end with this last period here. One way of talking about the new one is called the Anthropocene. And you'll hear this increasingly here. The scene here is a geologic term for a particular era or period of time. And what this simply means is that human beings have now become the dominant, and think about this a minute, the dominant geological force, the dominant biological force, and the dominant atmospheric force at a planetary scale. It's kind of mind-boggling to think about. You know, this is the first time that a single species has become a dominant geological force shaping the Earth's geology, or a biological force, natural selection has done that, or an atmospheric force. These have been done by things like volcanoes for the last 4.5 billion years. So this one really emphasizes the power that human beings have in this notion here. Thomas Berry coined a different term. He says we're entering the Ecozoic. And what he meant by that is that this will be the time where we're going to have to draw on all these powers of our symbolic consciousness to figure out how to live on an ecologically thriving planet. And this is, I think, and some of you think about it, this gives a really positive, hopeful sign to what it means to be human. We're going to have to marshal all of our creative powers to think about how we make a transition from the Cenozoic, and I would say from the Cenozoic through the Anthropocene, because I think that is part of where we are. But how do we get to here? How do we become a thriving planet for not just humans, but for all of life? The documentary hints at this a little bit. It says one of the challenges we've learned in the last 300 or 400 years to view the planet as simply a set of resources for our own use. And ironically, and I'm not trying to pick on the Holden mine here because everybody's part of the time, but this valley is a really good example about this. Right? This valley 100 years ago was seen as a really good source of minerals that could help the human community do well, and people didn't worry about the ecological costs about that. In fact, you even see some people familiar with the story of Holden. I forget, what was Holden's first name? Was it Peter Holden? But anyway, the fellow who discovered Holden was the guy who discovered the original ore body. But do people know what he did to this valley here when he was trying to look for ore? He found that the forests were too thick. It was too hard to see the rocks. So he burned the entire valley. I mean, we've been looking at the effects of fire most recently here, but this valley was pretty much, the entire valley was burned in the late 1800s as a means to try to find ore. And then once they found the ore, they developed this thriving community. And again, I'm not trying to point figures. It was precisely because this could bring tremendous human benefit to people. But people didn't think about what the ecological costs were. And now we have a legacy in this valley of the ecological damage that's taken somewhere between, I remember talking to Travis, somewhere between $500 million and $1 billion when you look at the total cost here to figure out what to do, and we'll have a lifelong legacy. That's reflective of the Anthropocene thinking, that the Earth exists for us to use it in whatever ways we can to help human beings. And I'm not minimizing the help it's given to human beings. It's given a lot of help. But it's made an ecologically unsustainable planet. So how do we marshal that power to move into the Ecozoic period when we have a planet where all of life can flourish again. That, I think, is one of our big challenges. Yeah?
I struggle a lot with the role of competition. You know, and I know that through our human development, competition has been, cooperation has been a big strong suit of ours, as has been competition. But it almost seems like it's getting to the point where competition might be actually a maladaptation or something that would actually prevent us from moving to the eco-zoic period.
No, it's a really good point here, because this, again, I think is part of that tension between our genetic heritage and our cultural heritage, and both of them here. We have co-evolved with lots of forms of life that have evolved both competition and cooperation. So there are times where we've competed with other human groups, we competed with other species, and that has brought us about some really important abilities to survive, including probably our symbolic consciousness. This is, the speculation is that when human beings that were early primates and we were moving out in the savanna in Africa, we were poorly adapted to that environment and we were at the mercy of a lot of real threats. Lions, hyenas, all sorts of predators there. And one of the things that happened that we moved there was we learned to stand upright. I put up three human traits that seem to have led to our thinking. Bipedalism is a really important one. Bipedalism did two things evolutionarily. It got us off of this position here where we couldn't see out over the shrubs of Vanna, so we could now see our pedal there. And it freed up half of our limbs, so we're no longer walking on them, and it freed up what became our hands with our opposable thumbs, which gave us incredible dexterity, and those things in turn led to much, much bigger brains, and then led to behavioral flexibility. So a lot of our tendency towards competition is right in our DNA. But so is cooperation. And the cooperation particularly comes with symbolic consciousness. That's why I was saying, this is why stories are so important. This is why you see everybody right now just fighting like the Dickens in our country to be able to tell the story of what's happening in the current administration here. It's all about media. It's all about social media. It's all about who gets to tell the story, because how we organize these stories shapes a lot about how we in turn live or don't live with each other here. And so this is a tension. When we have genetic predispositions to particular behaviors that are no longer culturally adaptive, what do we do with that? That happens in our sexuality, it happens in tendencies towards violence, it happens in our dietary issues. But what we've seen over and over again is that human beings are enormously flexible in terms of taking our symbolic consciousness and developing different cultural ways to adapt with that. I think it gets very challenging when we look at the pace of cultural change right now. But you're right. And I think it doesn't do us any good to ignore that's part of our DNA. It's embedded in there, but it doesn't mean it has to determine everything. We have to find other things. So some people said, for example, that sports is a really good way for us to let that competitive spirit in some folks here out in ways that don't hurt us. And so how do we find those different outlets on that? We've got time for just a few more questions or insights or comments. Barbara, yeah.
All right, I was just going to offer.
Yeah, please make a connection with any of the stuff you're teaching too, Barbara.
Well, about the image of God question, I mean, I think this is the big question, is how do we fit that in? What is the image of God? But two Sundays ago, was Trinity Sunday, where we got the image of God being relationship itself, and there's a kind of wonderful Greek Orthodox icon of the three friends. Yeah. And one thing I learned in this evolutionary anthropology course I was in, that number one and number two, bipedalism and big brains, that we're the only species that, by and large, the human cannot give birth without help. I mean, some women can, okay, it happens. but with bipedalism, had to come a narrowing of hips, and you've got these infants with these giant brains, so the huge risk is the trade-off that you're going have to have help giving birth. So that the very idea of relationship, and humans are the only ones, so it might be not just symbolic consciousness, but the very image of God in us might be this intense relationship that is part of who we very are and part of who God is, too. I mean, it's just, Celia Dean Drummond writes on it, but this is really interesting. Thank you. Being able to give birth is a very interesting point.
I'll tell you since Hal Tausig this morning confessed to not being worried about being called heretical, I'll confess my heretical thing here. I think the Genesis story tells part of the story. I have no problem with us being in somehow reflecting the image of God. But I also think whales do. And I think giraffes do. And I think ponderosa pines do. I mean, I think the incredible diversity of God's... I mean, why would God go to the problem of creating this incredible planet with 25 or 30 million species and only be concerned with one of them? I just think that's the incredible diversity and richness of life that reflects the image of God and all of God's diversity. And probably, and that's what excites me to think about, there's 200 billion more galaxies reflecting the image of God. They're there. And so for me, what that partly says, this is why I like to connect the Genesis story to the Noah story. Because what Noah does, and our evangelical sisters and brothers have been much better about lifting this up sometimes, is, you know, they call that the First Endangered Species Act. That in the story of Noah, God shows concern for protecting the incredible richness and diversity of life and commands Noah to make sure that all of life survives that catastrophe. And that, for me, if I were going to think of what's our stewardship responsibility this age, is to be Noah's. That we have this incredible earthly biodiversity that it's our sinfulness that's causing its destruction. And the reflection then is, how do we have all of it? So it's not just human survival. I really want to see survival of the whole planet and all of its richness in there. And if I think of the whole planet reflecting the image of God, then it becomes really problematic that I'm willing to sacrifice part of that image for my own sake, as opposed to really work hard and say all of this reflects God's glory. So that probably will get me in trouble in some doctrinal circles, but that's where I am coming from on this story here. So, yeah.
I think one of the things this video, and by the way, really appreciate the video. One of the things that it brought out is our inability maybe to even recognize life when we see it. And I think I kind of know where it's coming from. You know, as we look outside of the Earth and we're trying to think of, you know, what life on other planets might be like, it kind of forces you to think, well, if I don't see a tree, if I don't see a mammal, if I don't see a reptile, am I going to say there's no life on another planet? Because that's kind of how we think. We think in terms of trees and people and dogs and so on and so forth. But, you know, the video really extends the definition of life much broader than that. That may be a key as well to how we move ahead into this ecozoic period. You know, it's going to force us maybe to expand our definition of life.
Well, here's a point I'll make a connection with Barbara's point this morning, because the book of Revelation talks about a new world, you know, they're creating a new world. And I mean, what's the verb, Barbara, the verse in Revelation?
A new heaven and a new earth.
A new heaven and new earth. And there's been this, you know, question, does that depend on destroying or the destruction of this current one here? Or could we see ourselves as transformation? And I would love to connect the Revelation vision to this. Can we move through this period of destructiveness that we're currently in to be part of creating a new heaven, new earth, but not by destroying this one here, but by moving, transforming the destruction into a world that flourishes for all? That's the part that motivates me. And I'll say maybe the last thing is, one of the things I love about coming to Holden, there's so many different themes we could talk about in the movie here, but one of them, I hope you picked up on it, it talked about sometimes the concentration, bringing lots of different things together in a concentrated form, can lead to an explosive dimension of new creativity. And so with one of the things we see that in is the rise of the first cities becomes the basis of civilization, which has both destructive aspects, but an exponential increase in creativity. I feel really lucky because I work in a university setting here, and I think that university settings reflect that. They bring concentrated people together, and there's incredible cauldron of creativity in that. But I think Holden does this as well. This is one of the things I love about Holden, is we get us all together, and we're concentrating this, and it just, we get our minds, we get our symbolic consciousness working in really creative ways. And that, I think, is so important for how we begin to make this move into a planet of a life of planetary flourishing. So let's end there for today. Let me just tell you about what I'm going to be doing the rest of this week here, because frankly, I am a little amazed people keep coming inside here when it's so beautiful out there. So I want you to know what your trade-offs will be. I want to take three, we've been talking about the notion of deep time, and I want to take three different aspects of it that I think shape us today. So tomorrow in the morning, I'm going to be talking about deep time in terms of the geological story that shaped the Pacific Northwest. including Holden, but Puget Sound, that area there. So if you find that interesting, come to that. If you don't find it interesting, you can stay away. On Thursday, I'm going to be looking at deep time in terms of climate change. One of the things we've learned is that in 4.5 billion years of the planet, our climate has changed dramatically during that time, back and forth, all sorts of things. So we're going to use that as a backdrop to think about climate change, where we are today, and I'm going to talk a little bit about how the Earth has responded to the challenges of climate change in the past, and what that might suggest about how we might respond today. And then on Friday, I'm going to do one of my, I've never done a talk on this before, but it's one of my favorite topics. Now, how many folks here know the field of biomimicry? A familiar term, I see a few hands going up here. Biomimicry is this awareness that life has been around for a little under 4 billion years. And life has to always adapt to whatever environment it lives in. And so when we look at the record of life, we're looking at the record of design strategies for survival and flourishing. So can we look at how life has handled all these challenges to help us think about the challenges we have today? And this field of biomimicry is doing this in really wonderfully creative ways. And I'm going to give you some examples of that and then pretend that particularly the challenge of climate change. Can we use the insights of life itself to figure out how to adapt to climate change, since that's what life has been doing for 3.8 billion years? So that's what the rest of the week looks like in terms of this series. But I really thank you for your attention to these first two sessions, and I look for really good conversations.